Interesting subject for the first half hour of the program. We'll be talking about Martin Luther's theology of sex. Now, Luther, of course, is known for, at the time of the Reformation, bringing to light and insisting upon a clear exposition of the doctrine of justification by grace through faith alone, for Christ's sake alone. He's also known for insisting that all of this be based upon Scripture alone. Well, did this central doctrine of justification, did it affect, well, one's view of sex, of family, of children, of marriage? We'll find out here in the first 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. Dr. Alan Carlson will be our guest from the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society, based in Rockford, Illinois. In the next half hour of the program, from 3:30 to 4, first we'll be hearing a little bit from Nightline. They did a media package last night, a report on the FDA and on the morning after pill. We'll be hearing that, and then we'll be talking with Dr. John Wilkie of the Life Issues Institute, based in Cincinnati. We'll be speaking to him about the FDA and the morning after pill and getting his reaction to some of the things that were said in favor of the morning after pill on Nightline last night. That'll bring us up to the second hour of the program. In the second hour, Gretchen Passantino will be our guest. We'll talk about demon possession. The big movie in the box office is, of course, The Exorcism of Emily Rose. It's about a young girl who is possessed by the devil, and about a trial afterward, kind of pitting science and empiricism against religious views. We'll be talking about demon possession, what the Bible does and does not teach about the demonic realm, with Gretchen Passantino. Then we're going to be spending some time with David Prentice, and we'll discuss genetic manipulation. Let me see if I can manipulate my mouth in the proper direction. Genetic manipulation of human beings with Dr. David Prentice in the last hour of Issues, Etc. today. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Feel free to join us anytime in the next 3 hours. We begin our conversation with Dr. Alan Carlson, president of the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society, based in Rockford, Illinois, founder and general secretariat of the World Congress of Families, and author of a lecture titled A Revolutionary Theology of Sex, Martin Luther on Sex, Marriage, and Family. Dr. Carlson, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Pleased to be with you.
Well, of course, Luther is known for his theological stance against the Roman position in the 16th century. But did Luther at the time make any cultural contributions in the areas we're going to talk about?
Oh, indeed so. In fact, I think we can say that in Luther's perspective, his new movement, later called Protestantism, was as much a pro-family movement and a pro-life movement as it had to do with as religious questions and more strictly theological questions. He crafted a marvelous theology of sex, marriage, and family that I think is still very relevant today.
Is it still, I don't want to jump too far ahead, but is Luther's theology of sex, of family, marriage, is it still the prevailing view among those who count Luther as their theological forefather?
Well, let me explain a little bit of what he believed in. He was a firm opponent of contraception. He was a firm opponent of abortion. He believed that marriage was divinely ordained by God, that celibacy, for example, as practiced by the medieval church, was wrong. Women were born to be mothers and wives. Men were born to be fathers, house husbands. I think many Lutherans have lost their way on these questions. Certainly on the issue, for example, of contraception, it's rare to find Luther's views echoed today.
All right, then let's talk about, in the context of the 16th century, how Luther's view of marriage, sex, and the family differed in any way from the prevailing ideas of that day.
Back in the early 16th century, we need to remember that somewhere between 25% and a third of all adults were in holy orders of one kind or another. They were they were priests, they were monks, they were nuns, they were members of groups like the Teutonic Knights, which had been a crusading order, now had become merchants, but still took vows of celibacy, as all of these people did. So you had a large proportion of the adult population taking vows of celibacy, renouncing marriage, renouncing childbearing. The problem was is that particularly among the more wealthy Christian brotherhoods and sisterhoods, convents and so on, the celibacy was not working very well. Many were falling to temptation. The complaints of lay members of the church at the time about priests who were having affairs with their with the members of their church, of bishops who were maintaining concubines, a long list of sexual sins were part of the general problem facing the late medieval church. Luther claimed that celibacy was the problem, and mounted a campaign to do away with it, essentially.
So his objection to monastic orders went beyond the central objection, which had to do with the fact that, you know, this encourages a view that somehow man's works are meritorious before God, and that there are varying echelons of Christianity, and if you're in the order and celibate and devoted to God entirely. He also objected to orders because it didn't do a lot of good for everyday life, and they tended to give a picture of good works as though the real good works were taking place in the monastery. Well, sounds as though all these things are related to his views of family.
Well, they are indeed. In fact, he called, he said marriage was the true religious order, not living in a monastery, not living in a convent, but marriage was the true religious order. One wonderful line he had, he said, "It is not a matter of free choice and decision, but a natural and necessary thing that whatever is a man must have a woman, and whatever is a woman must have a man. Women were created to be wives and mothers, not created for lifelong virginity." And he built this on the biblical text, Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. God created man and woman and bound them to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Luther said that was not a suggestion on God's part. It was the one and only command prior to the fall, which still remained true and active and a requirement for Christians even after the fall. So for Luther, marriage was a huge deal. It was what God intended for his creatures. Marriage and procreation and raising children and good families was what God wanted us to do.
Kind of interesting, and I don't know how true this is, but the popular historical perception of Luther with regard to his own marriage was that he kind of had to be pushed into it. Is it true?
Well, there's some truth in that. For what is the way the story goes is he had taken on the obligation of a number of nuns who had fled from a convent and tried to find them good husbands. Katharina von Bora apparently liked Luther and decided pretty much early on that that's who she wanted to marry, and basically turned down his other suggestions and eventually won him over. Judging from Luther's theology of the family, all of which was written before his marriage, he was fulfilling his own sort of, how we say, he was finally doing what he said should be done. And and his marriage was an extremely happy one. Six children were born, and he became the model of the Protestant family.
We see pictures. I mean, you can go back and find art of Luther and his family, Christmas pictures around the table, engaging in music, all sorts of things that have come down from the time of the Reformation.
Well, he revolutionized family life and strengthened the home as a center of learning, of moral education, and of religious education. A wonderful book by Harvard historian Stephen Osmond called When Fathers Ruled, Family Life in Reformation Europe, emphasizes that never before or never since was the home and family life given such importance and such a priority in people's lives as it was in early Reformation Europe. The home became a religious center.
You note, Dr. Carlson, that there was in the late medieval church a somewhat schizophrenic view of marriage. On the one hand, it's considered a sacrament. On the other hand, we've already talked a bit about this, the Holy Orders institution seemed to argue that it was a lesser estate to celibacy.
That is true. And there were, while in a sense never formally enshrined as dogma at the time, that was certainly the perception and operated in some ways as the operational rule. That is, a truly holy person would enter, would take vows of celibacy, poverty, and be ordained, or enter a monastery or a convent. And those who were married were in some ways sort of second-rate Christians, not quite as holy. Luther turned that on its head and said, to the contrary, those who were truly living by God's will were those who were living in families, creating children, and rearing them in godly homes. That's what God intended for humankind.
You write about Luther's sexual egalitarianism. What do you mean by that?
Well, Luther believed in that within marriage, the husband and wife, in becoming one flesh, found a perfect equality. He wrote, whatever the husband has, this the wife has and possesses in its entirety. Their partnership involves not only the means, their means, but children, food, bed, and dwelling. Their purposes, too, are the same. The result is that the husband differs from the wife in no other respect than in sex, that is, or in gender. He believed that perfect equality between men and women was, again, part of God's intent, part of what it meant to be a Christian, but it could only be found in the bond of marriage. And he lived that. One thing he did, which really, again, surprised, even shocked and scandalized his time, is that at that point in time, almost all men, in leaving wills and bequests, would put a male relative in charge of the estate. Luther thought that was wrong. He put his wife in charge of his estate and directed his children to obey her as long as she should live, and that she would, in fact, share completely in his worldly possessions and indeed become his executor after his death. Again, highly unusual in the context of the times.
It sounds as though when it comes to the issues of marriage and family, one rightly understands Luther's views on these two things in light of his teaching on Christian vocation.
Precisely. For him, the highest estate or the highest vocation of men and women was fatherhood and motherhood, husbandry and housewifery. And it was a vocation that was godly. It was a godly calling, universal in its application. He did hold out the slight chance that one in maybe 1 in 1,000 people might have a natural gift of celibacy, but he thought it was rare and unusual. For God's this concept of vocation of worldly calling fit very closely to his family ethic.
When I was a parish pastor, Dr. Carlson, I often had occasion to teach Luther's small catechism, the larger catechism as well, and especially on the fourth commandment, teaching young people with regard to honoring parents. Luther has some pretty interesting things to say to parents, especially in the larger catechism, where he says, look, God doesn't really need parents to keep kids clothed and fed and warm at night. He could find someone else to do that. He gave you your children so that you might bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. This is your highest calling as parents. You mentioned before that Luther located spiritual education back in the home. Talk about that.
Well, he thought this was particularly the responsibility of fathers. He believed that when children were very young, from birth up until about age 6 or 7, the mother probably should take the primary responsibility. In the early years, they would still be nursing. But once the reason started to form, he said it's the father's job now to shape the child spiritually and morally. The Protestant fathers of the 16th century published and read widely some books called house father books, which were sort of self-help books for dads. But they were designed for the father to become the religious and moral educator of his family. And that was the male's responsibility, home-focused. It was the father's job to do this, not the mother's.
We're talking with Dr. Alan Carlson about Luther's theology of sex, marriage, and the family here in the first half hour of Issues, Etc. Dr. Carlson is president of the Howard Center for Religion, Family, Religion, and Society based in Rockford, Illinois. In about 10 minutes, we're going to take up the conversation. Well, we're going to be hearing from Nightline last night. They had a special report on the FDA and the morning after pill, and they'll be talking about that with Dr. John Wilkie of Life Issues Institute based in Cincinnati. That's coming up here in about 10 minutes. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. What did Luther's view of Christian freedom, if you could explain that briefly, what did it have to do, or how did it influence Luther's view of sex, marriage, and the family?
Well, Luther looked at prevailing teaching of the late medieval church, and there were 18 impediments to marriage. Now, in truth and practice, most of these impediments would be done away with if one made a contribution to the right episcopal coffer. You put a little money payment, you could get an exception through. But Luther asked the question, where are these impediments found in Scripture? And he couldn't find them. There were listed in Leviticus certain prohibitions on marrying one's mother, one's stepmother, one's aunt, and so on. And he said, this is what God intended. And he went back to the Old Testament text and said, if this is it. So what that meant was, for example, one of the impediments was you could not marry someone who was blind. Deaf people could not marry. Luther said, that's foolish. That's crazy. He believed in the right to marry. He even, for example, believed in the marriage of a Christian to a non-Christian. He saw it as a chance for proselytizing, but even if a Christian wanted to marry a Muslim, he said, okay, well, that's you're fulfilling God's will in the marriage. Again, that would have been impossible under the older rules. Luther said, except what God has forbidden, specifically in Leviticus, one should have a freedom to marry. Now, I do underscore, since this is sort of a current debate, it never dawned on him that anyone would extend that to the right of same-sex couples to marry. But surely he would have opposed that stridently and vociferously. It would have been something unthinkable to him.
He had a very, in that regard, I mean, we could extrapolate from what he does say about a very clear biblical view of the distinction between the sexes, between male and female, and their proper places, not only in family and marriage or in society, but also in the eyes of God.
He surely saw that men and women had different roles within this common equality. But again, something that's quite modern about Luther, he has some tender passages I just love. I call them the diaper passages, where he talks about how the Christian father takes a joy in changing the diapers of his children because he's doing so in Christian love. So that even though there are clear roles that fathers and mothers have, Luther almost sounds like a kind of a modern late 20th, early 21st century guy who's in there changing diapers along with the mother, in there providing direct child care and baby care in a way that sounds very modern, very conventional, and very very contemporary.
Would this have been the norm? I mean, Luther married into nobility, and Catherine von Bora was of some minor nobility, and Luther himself in time was a man of stature in society and had some wealth. Would it have been the norm for someone in his status of society to raise their own kids that way?
No, the norm, particularly among the wealthy, was to heavy use of nurse midwives and of nurses and of wet nurses. It's very common for noble women to put their babies out to breastfeed on among peasants and so on. Luther just condemned this again and again. He was an advocate for the intact, what later would be called the nuclear family, but the home. And that parenting was the most important task and should not be consigned to servants and paid caregivers. He certainly would be appalled today by the widespread use of daycare. He'd find that just a terrible and awful violation of the integrity of the home and of the parent-child bond.
Some quick final questions here, Dr. Carlson. What do we know of Luther's thought on divorce?
Well, he opened the door slightly. The passage in Matthew where Jesus acknowledges that divorce is acceptable in a fallen world for the cases of adultery, Luther said, okay. In cases of adultery, divorce is okay. But he had some caveats added to that. He wasn't exactly what he called easy divorce. He argued many times that the adulterer, after the divorce, should be executed, and at other times that that even after a divorce based on adultery, only the victim, in a sense, the person who'd remained faithful, would be allowed to remarry. He also would allow divorce in cases of denial of conjugal rights. Again, procreation he saw as a necessary act, part of marriage, and also to those who were completely incompatible. But in that case, even though a divorce would happen, neither party would be allowed to remarry, should be allowed to remarry. So while he opened the door slightly to divorce, it was a very, very limited and very small opening. He certainly would not have approved of the no-fault divorce regime we have in the United States today.
You asked the question. I want the answer to this, and then I have one final quick question. How would we judge, then, the success of Luther's family ethic or theology of sex?
I think it worked remarkably well for about 400 years into the early 20th century. It worked remarkably well. But I'd have to say that Lutherans have not done a very good job in the second half of the 20th century, and we're struggling with it. We've jettisoned a good number of some of his key provisions. Say, started with contraception, and then some Lutheran churches, some Lutheran bodies, at least grew tolerant of abortion in some cases. We've also de-emphasized the home, I think, have not given it enough support. Churches who rush to build daycare centers, for example, in hopes of attracting young married families, I think are going at it the wrong way. They should be working to support child rearing at home, which is where Luther thought it should be, and strengthening homes rather than in some ways contributing to their weakening.
Then finally, with only 30 seconds, Dr. Carlson, if Luther were alive today and could see what was going on, especially in American society, how vocal would he be on the life issue and other social issues?
Oh, I think Luther would be on the cutting edge of these issues. He would be appalled by our abortion culture. He would be appalled by our culture of divorce. He would be appalled by a society where the average married couple has fewer than two children. He would just think that we're not obeying God's will. We're not... We're violating God's will. I think he would be right in the forefront of the life and family issues. He would be strident, and he would be unpopular.
Profam.org, P-R-O-F-A-M.O-R-G is the website for the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society, Profam.org. Dr. Alan Carlson is president of the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society, founder and general secretariat of the World Congress for Families, and author of a lecture titled A Revolutionary Theology of Sex, Martin Luther on Sex, Marriage, and Family. Dr. Carlson, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for being our guest.
I've really enjoyed it.
When we come back from this break, Nightline last night was talking about the morning after pill. We'll hear a little bit of that show, and then we'll talk with Dr. John Wilkie about it.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Is it possible that one of the most popular and long-lived religious movements in U.S. history is based entirely on a hoax? Did Joseph Smith receive the Book of Mormon from heaven, or did he steal it from Solomon Spaulding? How did Spaulding's work of fiction become the Book of Mormon? Find answers to these questions in our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon? Ask for this book at either of Concordia Publishing House's bookstores, one at 3558 South Jefferson in the city, the other on the campus of Concordia Seminary in Clayton. The book is $16.99 plus shipping and handling. Those two locations, 3558 South Jefferson in the city or in Clayton on the campus of Concordia Seminary. Follow the signs to the CPH bookstore and ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon?
Satellite TV systems allow users in the Middle East, North Africa, and Central Asia to receive the latest news from around the world. This Global Minute urges you to pray for more good Christian programming via satellite. Several different ministries produce television programs to share Christ with viewers living in what is known as the 1040 window. You may have heard about this enormous region stretching from North Africa through Central Asia. 97% of the world's least evangelized people live in this section. Avant Ministries states media gives Christians a wonderful opportunity to present Christ to people who have never heard about Him. People who ordinarily would never step inside a church, even if there was one close by. Pray for Christian programmers to have Christ-inspired creativity in their programming. Get inspired to share Christ around the globe with free motivational messages from people like Pastor John Piper. Learn more at missionvisionnetwork.org. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Cindy Sheehan, the mother who lost her son in Iraq, is using her grief to fuel her anti-war protests. Pamela Halal lost her son Derek in a battle in the Al Anbar province. Why hadn't God answered our prayers? Pamela complained. What purpose could this possibly fulfill? Going through son Derek's personal effects, Pamela found comfort and purpose for her grief. She wrote, Derek had been invited to give his testimony to our youth group upon returning home after his 7-month deployment. He never had the opportunity to do that, at least not in person. Tears streamed down my cheeks as I read what he had prepared. I had been confident our son was with the Lord. At that moment, I became more assured than ever. The final point of Derek's witness, of everything I learned in boot camp, he wrote, this is the best thing. Praise God all the time, not just when you're in trouble. God will be there and has a plan for you, no matter what you think. Derek's parents have used their energies to share his witness with thousands of people. Pamela Halal's story is in a great new volume entitled God Answers Prayers, Military Edition. It's edited by Allison Botke. The subtitle, True Stories from People Who Serve and Those Who Love Them. How are you using the energies of your grief?
How would you like to meet Issues Etc. regular guests Wesley Smith, Beverly Yonke, Jean Edward Veith, James Lamb, Bob Weiss, David Menton, and Nathan Jastrom all in one day? Well, they'll be speaking at the Image of God Bioethics Conference Friday, November the 11th at the Sheraton Westport Lakeside Chalet in St. Louis. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org, and join us as we broadcast live from the Image of God Bioethics Conference November the 11th in St. Louis. Welcome back to Issues Etc. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking with Dr. John Wilkie, president of Life Issues Institute based in Cincinnati, about, well, you may have seen this in the paper. Reuters is reporting regulators delay decision on Bar's morning after pill. Bar is the manufacturer of this pill that is intended to be taken after a sexual encounter. That is, everyone is saying it's a contraceptive. The question is it an abortifacient? Is it really a chemical abortion? Well, last night, on Nightline, they did an entire program on the FDA and the morning after pill. We'll be talking with Dr. John Wilkie about that. But first, we're going to hear a segment from last night's Nightline, a special report from Lisa Stark on the FDA and the morning after pill. Then, when we rejoin our conversation with Dr. John Wilkie, we'll get his reaction to some of the things that were said during Ted Koppel's interview that followed this special report. Here's the special report on the FDA and the morning after pill from Lisa Stark from last night's Nightline.
In December 2003, two FDA advisory committees met to decide whether Plan B, the morning after pill, should be sold without a prescription. The vote was overwhelmingly in favor, 23-4.
Yes.
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 The pill must be taken within 72 hours after intercourse to be effective. That's why advocates say it's important it be made over-the-counter so a woman doesn't have to wait for her doctor to prescribe it.
I am opposed. Vote no.
Dr. David Hager is one of the four on the advisory panel who voted against Plan B. An OBGYN from Kentucky, Dr. Hager describes himself as pro-life.
I did not feel comfortable at that time indicating that I favored over-the-counter sale with no age limitation whatsoever. A 9-10-year-old could purchase the medication as easily as a 25-year-old.
After the vote, Dr. Hager said he was asked, he won't say by whom, to write a letter to the head of the FDA.
I wrote a letter to the commissioner just explaining my concerns to make sure that those had been conveyed to the commissioner's office.
In May 2004, the FDA, in essence, sided with Hager. In a rare move, it rejected the advice of both its panel and senior staff, citing concerns about usage among younger girls. The FDA told the manufacturer, Bar Pharmaceuticals, to reapply. Bar did that, asking the drug be made available over-the-counter for females 16 or older. Those younger would still need a doctor's prescription. 5 months later, speaking at a Christian college, Dr. Hager took some credit for that.
I argued it from a scientific perspective, and God took that information, and he used it through this minority report to influence a decision. You don't have to wave your Bible to have an effect as a Christian in the public arena.
I'm Wendy Wright with Concerned Women for America, and we're very disturbed by Plan B's promoters' emphasis on access, but not on women's safety.
Wendy Wright is with Concerned Women for America. Its mission is to bring, quote, biblical principles into all levels of public policy. Her organization played a lead role in fighting to keep the drug prescription only.
This will end up making particularly minor girls more vulnerable to statutory rapists. A 40-year-old man could go in and buy this drug, give to a 13-year-old girl in order to cover up and continue his sexual abuse of that girl.
The FDA promised it would make a decision by January 2005. The deadline passed. At that point, Senators Hillary Rodham Clinton and Patty Murray decided to play hardball politics.
We said the Senate will not approve Lester Crawford as FDA commissioner until he gives us a timeline for an answer on whether Plan B will be approved as an over-the-counter drug.
The FDA has a very broad and critical mission in protecting the public health.
A deal was struck. Crawford was confirmed as FDA commissioner in July after the FDA promised a decision on Plan B by September 1st, more than 2 years after the original application was submitted. Meantime, Wendy Wright and her group kept up the pressure on the FDA.
The FDA staff and the advisory committee did not look at the overall effect that making this drug easily available can end up having.
Is that their job, or is their job to determine if a drug is safe and effective?
When we are at an epidemic rate in the United States of STDs, we as a society need to be taking a more serious look at it.
If a young woman chose to use emergency contraception, then would she not come in to see her physician for regular contraceptive prescription, to be screened for sexually transmitted infections, to have her pap smear?
On the last Friday in August at 4 p.m., the FDA finally made its announcement. It decided not to decide.
The agency is unable at this time to reach a decision on the approvability of the application because of these unresolved regulatory and policy issues that relate to the application we were asked to evaluate.
The FDA asked for another 60 days for public comment. Senator Murray was furious.
Rather, it's been delayed and delayed and delayed. We are only left to wonder why, and the only answer I can come up with is politics.
I think the FDA has shown that it's sensitive to the concerns of our society, and they have rightly looked beyond some ideologues within the medical community to see how will the public be affected by this decision.
The final decision on Plan B will be in the hands of a new FDA commissioner. Just last week, Lester Crawford resigned as head of the FDA. This is Lisa Stark for Nightline in Washington.
All right, that's the Nightline story last night, their special report on the FDA and the morning after pill. We're going to be talking about it here for the next few minutes of Issues Etc. with Dr. John Wilkie, president of Life Issues Institute based in Cincinnati, and we'll be getting his reaction to some of the things that were said after that report last night on Nightline. Ted Koppel interviewed someone who was in favor of FDA approval for the over-the-counter sale of the morning after pill. Now, coming up after our conversation with Dr. Wilkie, we're going to spend some time, let's see, we're going to be hearing from someone down in Texas, if I'm not mistaken, on the aftermath of Hurricane Rita, and then Gretchen Passantino will join us. Gretchen will join us in the middle of the next hour for an hour-long conversation on demon possession. What does the Bible teach about demon possession? What is it? Can a Christian be possessed by the devil? It's all in light, of course, of the blockbuster movie, The Exorcism of Emily Rose. We'll find out what Gretchen has to say about that, and we'll take that subject wherever it takes us in the course of that hour-long conversation. We'll spend the last half hour of Issues Etc. talking with Dr. David Prentice about genetic manipulation of human beings. He's from Indiana State University, and that'll be the last 25 minutes of Issues Etc. If you'd like to join us as we talk with our next guest, Dr. John Wilkie, about the FDA and the morning after pill. The FDA commissioner just resigned. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You know, we've been talking about this morning after pill for an awful long time, but I want you to note a couple of things before our conversation with Dr. Wilkie begins. First of all, we're talking about the request before the FDA is that it approve over-the-counter sales for this drug, not for women only, but also for what you and I normally call girls, minor children, your minor children. We'll be talking about the FDA in the morning after pill. Dr. John Wilkie is president of Life Issues Institute, based in Cincinnati. Dr. Wilkie, welcome.
Oh, glad to be here.
What should the FDA do about this Bar Pharmaceuticals drug, the morning after pill, or Plan B?
Well, first of all, we have to understand what that drug does. In order to do this, we have to continually tell people what happens in the first week of life. When sperm joins ovum, well, first of all, when sperm joins ovum, you have conception. All right? Then for the next 7 days, this brand new human floats freely down the woman's tube, and when he or she is 1 week old, this new living human embryo plants within the nutrient lining of her womb. Then he sends out roots into the wall, taps into her bloodstream, and sends a chemical hormonal message into her bloodstream, which goes to a gland at the base of her brain. This notifies her body that she's got a new passenger down there, and this same chemical stops her from having the period that she normally would then be expecting. So that's the routine. Now, let's see what this pill does. When best way to do this is to use a couple of examples. First of all, they take this morning after pill, this Plan B, after having had sex. All right, let's say she has sex on Saturday night and sperm is deposited in her body. It swims through her internal organs and gets out to her ovary as rapidly as 30 minutes. Now, let's say in this case she had an egg waiting. Sperm joins the egg and she is fertilized. Now, this is Saturday night in bed. She takes the pill Sunday morning. Okay, what happens then? Well, apparently nothing, because it can't prevent the fertilization. She is already pregnant. But that pill hardens the lining of the uterus and prevents that one-week-old human from planting. And that one-week-old human dies, and this is what we call a one-week-old abortion. Now, there is another scenario. Let's have another lady who has sex on Saturday night and takes the pill on Sunday morning. All right, in her case, she did not have an egg waiting, and her body wasn't programmed to release that egg until Tuesday. She took the pill Sunday morning. What that pill can do is stop the release of the egg on Tuesday, and she never gets pregnant. She's never fertilized. So the pill in that case was a contraceptive. Now, there is, of course, a third option there, and that is that she wasn't fertile and that she just took the pills needlessly, and that's about 9 shots out of 10 statistically. So what we are being told is that the morning after pill prevents pregnancy. Well, in the one case that I mentioned, that's apparently so. But certainly in the first case I talked about, it didn't prevent anything except that it killed a one-week-old human. And for that reason, we call this pill an abortion pill, and of course we oppose it.
All right, I'd like your reaction to some of the things that were said last night on Nightline. There was a feature that did the entire episode on the FDA and the morning after pill. And after a special report from Lisa Stark, there was an interview between Ted Koppel and a guest who is in favor of the FDA approval for over-the-counter sale of Plan B. I'd like your reaction to this.
This product is very safe. There's not much concern that it will cause as a safety issue. The question that was raised by a very small part of the agency was whether or not they could understand the label and use it properly. But we've never asked that question about any other product. We don't ask it about pain medication. We don't ask it about cold medication. We don't ask it about condoms or any other contraceptive method that's available over the counter. This is very, very safe. There's no question about its safety. There's no question that it's more effective if it's used within hours, not within days.
All right, Dr. Wilkie, the safety is a question, but from what your previous answer indicates is it may be safe for the women, but not for the baby.
Well, that's clearly the moral objection to it. However, we do have other objections. This pill was legalized for over-the-counter use in England about 5 years ago. Now, they used the same arguments to get it legal that we're hearing here. Okay, it will prevent pregnancies. Therefore, it will prevent abortions and so forth. As a matter of fact, teenage pregnancy has gone up every year in England since it's been available. What's more important, perhaps, is that sexually transmitted disease has gone up very rapidly since that time. So what we know is happening is that these kids are snuckering down on a Saturday night. Should we do it or not? Well, yeah, let's do it, and I'll just take the pill. So with the pill, you don't need any other protection. So we have a skin-to-skin contact, and we have a sexual disease transmitted, and she gets pregnant but aborts at 1 week of life. There's the thing that is really insidious here is that we are seeing mature men in England carrying the pills with them. They'll seduce an underage girl, have sex with her, and then feed her the pill afterwards so that they, the man, don't get in trouble with her pregnancy. So what we're seeing is a lot of statutory rape in England. We're seeing a rise in venereal disease. We're seeing a rise in pregnancy. And we're seeing a substantial amount more of sex in teenagers because the pill is now available. And I don't know that you have to even lean on the moral aspects of this in order to be opposed to the pill, because I think those are pretty good reasons that we've learned in England.
Dr. Wilkie, here again is former Assistant FDA Director Susan Wood in an interview with Ted Koppel last night on Nightline talking about the morning after pill.
That's really the central difference, is the timing. It works in a mechanism very similar to many other birth control pills. The mechanism is very similar. It just has to be taken after. And the sooner you take it after, the more effective. If you need it on Saturday morning, waiting until you get to a physician, either by phone or in person, to get a prescription by Monday morning, it's too late, and it doesn't work. And the worst thing that can happen is that you would have an unintended pregnancy.
Your reaction, Dr. Wilkie?
Well, first of all, if she was fertile when they had intercourse, she was pregnant before she got out of bed. And so you take it sooner, well, take it a day later, take it 2 days later. It doesn't make much difference because she was already pregnant. When this pill is taken after fertilization, it can't undo the fact that she has now been fertilized. Repeat. She is probably pregnant before she gets out of bed, and what the pill does 1 week later is kill a one-week-old human.
That seems to be the one thing here, Dr. Wilkie, that the proponents of the morning-after pill don't want to talk about. They want to continue to discuss this solely in terms of its contraceptive function rather than its potential abortive function.
Now, the other thing is that they have redefined the word conception. If you look in some medical dictionaries today, and this is first in the history of the world, they defined conception as implantation at 1 week of life. So if, and fertilization still means union of sperm and egg. So if you use their definition of conception, and that's what they're using, then this is a contraceptive, even if it kills a one-week-old developing baby. And so they're using a brand-new definition, which you don't know anything about, but they are very cleverly using this new definition.
So there appears to be several very good reasons why the FDA should not approve the morning-after pill for over-the-counter sale without a prescription to women and minor children. Number one, and first and foremost, you have pointed out several times, this is, in many cases, an abortifacient. Number two, there is the question of its effect on the ready effect of on society of making something this available to anybody, really, who wants to go in and who can manage to put down enough money for it. Have I summarized the best arguments here? Is there more to say?
And it promotes teenage promiscuity, no question about that. And it promotes, adult promiscuity for that matter. There's one thing we haven't mentioned, and that's this. It has not been tested in women under 18. We don't know if it has any other bad medical effects in younger women. And that's why the FDA has said they don't want to do it, even if they permit over-the-counter. They don't want it sold under 18, which, in fact, it is being sold in England and now some other countries. So that's another angle here. It should be thoroughly tested in younger women. It has not been.
Where do you think the pressure for approval of over-the-counter sales for the morning-after pill is coming from?
Planned Parenthood is the main pusher here. Drug companies who would sell the pill. The whole liberal, radical portion of our society that wants free sex for anybody, anytime, anywhere, either with men or women, married or not, etc. And so there's a lot of people out there who feel this way, not nearly the majority, but a lot. And they think the more libertarian their laws can be, the more they like it. So certainly that. But I think if you want to point to one single organization, it's Planned Parenthood.
And then finally, how would you react to those who say what the FDA is really doing is they don't want to approve this for over-the-counter sales, they don't have the will to do it, and so they just keep on changing the rules as the game goes by, or as Kirsten Moore of the Reproductive Health Technologies Project has said, the FDA keeps moving the goalposts.
Well, they can say that if they wish. The one lady who testified, who was one of the assistants there who we've just heard from, was a radical, pro-abortion, liberal feminist in the FDA, and she was pushing for this. She finally resigned, thank God. So Clinton appointed Mr. Crawford in charge. Crawford was on our side of this. And he has then said, no, we're not going to do it. We're not going to do it now, but I'm not sure when we'll ever do it. Well, unfortunately, Mr. Crawford's private life was revealed to be something less than exemplary. And he now has resigned. There's a temporary director in right now, and he's formerly associated with the American Cancer Society with a strong record of being pro-abortion. So it looks like we've got a bad guy in. He's listed as temporary. I think we have to try and get to the president again so that the person he puts in there is more objective. Right now, the head of the FDA would certainly favor anything that would allow more promiscuity.
Is there anything that our listeners can do during the process of the president considering a replacement?
Write to the president, White House, President of the United States. Please appoint a new FDA commissioner who is pro-life. Your interim commissioner is not.
Lifeissues.org is the website address for Life Issues Institute, lifeissues.org. Dr. John Wilkie is the president of Life Issues Institute, based in Cincinnati. Thank you for being our guest, Dr. Wilkie.
Thanks for asking me.
All right, when we come back from this break, we're going to spend some time talking about Hurricane Rita and Katrina relief efforts. Carlos Hernandez will be our guest. He's director of districts and congregations for LCMS World Relief and Human Care. Also, Lou Jander will join us on that subject from the Texas District of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. We'll get an update on what's going on down there in areas affected by both Rita and Katrina. We'll be spending some time after that with Gretchen Passantino. She's going to join us about halfway through that second hour. The big movie in the box office now is The Exorcism of Emily Rose, based upon a true story. Well, we know what the movies are going to show us about demon possession. It's going to be interesting. It might be accurate. It might not be accurate. It'll certainly be scary. What does the Bible teach about demon possession? Can Christians be possessed by demons? And what is this realm of the demonic? Should Christians be stepping into it to do what is so commonly called today spiritual warfare? We'll talk with Gretchen Passantino of Answers in Action about that. And then in the last half hour of the program, Dr. David Prentice joins us. We'll talk about the genetic manipulation of human beings. He's from Indiana State University. Our call-in numbers for the remainder of today's program, second hour and third, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Now, if you're interested in calling about our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, it's a different number. Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September is called Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon, The Spalding Enigma. This is a book of history, a little bit of mystery, and of course very enlightening as to the true origins of the Holy Book of the Latter-day Saints. Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon is $16.99 plus shipping and handling. Call 1-800-325-3040, that's the number for Concordia Publishing House, and ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, 1-800-325-3040, or you can browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org. Right there on our homepage, issuesetc.org, you will find our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon, 1-800-325-3040. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.